Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On today's show, we continue our two-week series on the presidential candidates' records, policies, and donors. Yesterday, we talked about former South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg. Tomorrow, we will talk about Elizabeth Warren. Today, we're talking about Senator Bernie Sanders, who is now the front runner. His support climbed 9 points to 31% since December, according to a poll from NPR, PBS NewsHour, and Marist. In the last week, over 50,000 people have attended rallies for Bernie Sanders. On Monday afternoon, over 10,000 people attended a rally in Richmond, California. And on Monday night, over 17,000 people rallied in Tacoma, Washington. Bernie Sanders has served in elected office for decades, first as mayor of Burlington, Vermont, then as a congressman, and finally as a senator. His campaign has raised a whopping $109 million, according to Open Secrets. He has $18 million on hand and spent $50 million in the last 3 months of 2019. Bernie Sanders has the most individual donors of any candidate. He received small donations from 1.4 million people through the end of 2019, according to the New York Times. Last year, he raised $96 million from donors without holding any high-dollar fundraising events. His loyal donors tend to give repeatedly. Sometimes they give $5. His campaign says most of his donors, 55%, give $200 or less. Sanders, who has spent 10 years fighting Citizens United, is the only candidate who has not accepted money from billionaires. After Marta Thoma-Hall, who is married to a billionaire, sent the Sanders campaign a $470 check, they decided to return it. CNBC reports that not one S&P 500 CEO is donating to Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren. So joining us to talk about donors, Bernie's record, and his policies is John Nichols. John is national affairs correspondent for The Nation magazine. He also hosts Next Left, The Nation's podcast featuring interviews with rising progressive politicians. John is the author of many books, including his most recent, Horsemen of the Trumpocalypse, a field guide to the most dangerous people in America. Hi, John. Welcome back to the show.
It's a great pleasure to be with you.
Well, it's great to have you, John. I just want to mention a few other things because I think it's so important to follow the money. Recode reports that this is really interesting. Bernie Sanders is raising more money from tech employees than any other candidate. Amazon, Apple, Facebook, Google, and Twitter gave him about $270,000. Their bosses overwhelmingly support Pete Buttigieg. So the workers are supporting Bernie. The bosses are supporting Pete Buttigieg. Also, he doesn't have super PACs working for him, like big dollar super PACs, but he does have the National Nurses Union. They spent about $70,000 in late 2019 on things like placards and T-shirts. And then you have the Sunrise PAC, which was created by the Sunrise Movement, and they're doing a lot of door knocking. The one criticism I saw about his funding, John, is Common Cause filed a complaint with the Federal Election Commission alleging that Our Revolution, the nonprofit political organization established by Sanders in 2016, is not releasing names of big donors. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, they should release the names of the big donors.
Right.
I'm always for transparency with all groups, or at least the best you can. I know it's complicated sometimes because some organizations have, they raise money for all sorts of different things and all sorts of different purposes, and I hear all the explanations. But at the end of the day, I just think it makes sense that when there are organizations that are closely tied with a candidate, you want to see who's funding them as well.
Right. And what we can conclude from what we've talked about so far is that Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, out of all the candidates, are taking the least amount of money from very wealthy people.
Yeah, I think that's the real takeaway.
Right.
It's an interesting thing that when you see public interest groups raising concerns about, campaigns, the reality is that the Sanders campaign, by almost all evidence, is a campaign that kind of breaks the mold, right? It doesn't rely on big money in any sense. Yes, as you point out, it's got some union support. And unions are going to do mobilization with their members, and that's beneficial to a candidate. It's got support of young people who want to save the planet, and they're knocking on doors, and that's a benefit. But at the end of the day, when you look at the Sanders campaign, what you come away with is a sense that they really are staking out a new way of funding a presidential campaign. And this is true also, it's also true with Warren to a large extent. And it was true, although he didn't have just small donors, he had some slightly larger donors. It was true with Andrew Yang, who frankly just raised a lot of money from grassroots folks. And this is something that we ought to note in our politics today, because we clearly have now three models for funding campaigns. One is a billionaire who just spends his own money, and that's Michael Bloomberg. But it's not just him. We have quite a few examples in the Senate, in governorships, other places, mayoralties, where very wealthy people essentially, you know, pay their way in to the process. The second way, the most traditional, is where, frankly, generally wealthier and more interested people on the right and the left, Democrats and Republicans, but, you know, I think a little more overwhelmingly Republicans, you know, fund it with big checks, big donors, the standard model that we've seen a lot of, and a lot of Wall Street influence, stuff like that. And then we have this final model, which is small donors. And we don't know how far that will go. It's a fascinating thing, which, you know, I know we're going to talk about other things here, but you could devote a whole show to it, because it is this, in my mind, optimistic possibility, the possibility that small donors could, in fact, influence the process in ways that are sufficient to counterbalance big money. But I want to emphasize, we do not know if that's going to be the case. That's one of the great issues that will be settled, I think, by the 2020 Democratic presidential race, where you literally have Sanders with this small donor model and Bloomberg with the exact opposite.
Well, and I should say that I got my numbers wrong yesterday when I talked about Trump and the Republican National Committee. Some numbers say that they have raised a whopping $850 million already. So whoever is the nominee on the Democratic side has to raise a lot of money. But where it comes from actually matters. John, let's dive in and talk about Sanders' record here, because he's a 30-year veteran of Congress. He's got a long track record. And Matthew Iglesias had a piece over at Vox called Mainstream Dems Should Not Fear Bernie Sanders. And he pointed out that Sanders has staked out lonely, courageous stands against the invasion of Iraq or the Defense of Marriage Act, for example, which barred same-sex couples from having the same benefits as married couples. He points out that Sanders casts sometimes meaningless protest votes against big bipartisan compromise that sail through with huge majorities. And he also does compromise. For example, he voted for the Children's Health Insurance Program reauthorization bill, and again for the Affordable Care Act, even though he didn't think they went far enough. He also points out that Sanders has a very strong record when it comes to veterans' health care. He worked with Republicans to produce bipartisan bills on this. What else strikes you about his record? I mean, he's got a long track record. What stands out for you?
He has a very, very long track record. And in fairness, it goes back even before his congressional service. He was elected to the House of Representatives in 1990, defeating a Republican incumbent. But before that, he had run for the House, and he had run for governor of Vermont as a viable independent candidate. He had served, as you noted, as mayor. As a younger man, he had been a third-party candidate for office in Vermont in the 1970s. So this is a guy who really has been in and around politics from a number of different perspectives for a very, very long time. He has always been on the left, and he's often been quite willing to take dangerous votes. He was a vote against the Patriot Act, in the House. When my good colleague refers to the anti-Iraq war vote as a lonely vote, it wasn't really a lonely vote. You had 23 senators who voted against it, and a very substantial number of Democratic House members who voted against it. It's one of the lost realities of the Iraq war. There really was tremendous opposition to it.
Yeah.
It just wasn't sufficient. And one of the troubling things in the Democratic Party was that the higher you went up in the hierarchy of the Democratic Party, the more likely they were to vote for the war, or at least for authorization of Bush. And that's lingered in our politics. But I do think that it's relevant to note that Sanders has done a lot of anti-war votes over the years, a lot of votes that challenge or critique our foreign policy. He's actually been particularly notable on that in recent years on issues like Yemen, working with Roel Khanna, Mark Pocan, Barbara Lee, and others. And so that's a distinctive part of him. He's generally been very strong on civil liberties. And you point out on Defense of Marriage Act, which really, I think, was an important, or super important vote. Another important vote in that period was on so-called welfare reform. And in that period, in the 90s, you did see Sanders staking out a lot of positions that were to the left of the Clinton administration on a host of issues. But I would really emphasize he wasn't alone. He was in the camp of people like Paul Wellstone and Russ Feingold and a handful of other progressives in the House and the Senate, Barbara Lee in the House very much. And so that's who he is. As regards effectiveness, it's an interesting dynamic. On the Veterans Committee, he was actually, I think, quite strikingly effective and worked very, very well with a host of people, Republicans, Democrats, centrists, conservatives. It was actually something that probably ought to be more deeply explored by folks who want to kind of look at how the guy operates in a position of power, right? Because he was, for a brief period there, in a leadership position. And the evidence was that he did quite well. He was tough. He was demanding. He really tried to get a lot more funding for veterans' concerns and veterans' issues. And he frankly found some conservative allies for that, which worked out pretty well. On some other issues, which is interesting, and this is one, the final kind of element of how the guy operates, when he was in the House and somewhat in the Senate, but more so in the House, on issues such as trade policy and war and peace, and some other areas, he was often quite good at forming alliances with very conservative Republicans. And he would kind of search out the Republicans who were, deeply committed to their views, who, weren't necessarily just lockstep party votes, and say, hey, I've noticed you don't really like these trade deals that much. Maybe you're from the Carolinas or someplace like that. You want to work together. Or I've noticed you really seem to not like unauthorized wars. Do you want to work together on some of that? And the classic story was that he actually worked very, very well with Walter Jones from down in the Carolinas, who's a former congressman who's passed away. But Walter Jones, and he actually did a lot of things together, even though they dramatically disagreed. And famously, one time I was talking to Walter Jones about this, and I said, it's interesting that you work together so well on so many issues. And he said, well, yeah, I don't mind, working with a liberal who's principled and who I know where he's coming from. Sometimes that's better than a moderate who I'm not sure where they're really at. And I said, well, Sanders isn't actually a liberal. He's a democratic socialist. And Walter Jones said, I know, I was trying to be polite.
Well, and John, the other question I have for you is about foreign policy under Bernie Sanders. He's one of the, one of the few in national politics who is critical of Israel. And when he's asked about Israel, as he was last night at the CNN town hall, he brings up the rights of Palestinians. He talks about what's happening in Gaza. This is happening a little bit more now, but it is still pretty rare when you're talking about national politics. He is a huge critic of the U.S. alliance with Saudi Arabia. Overall, pretty skeptical of the expansive military in this country. Although some people did point out that he has really not taken on the weapons industry over the years. I believe that Lockheed Martin has some factories in Vermont. But what are your thoughts about, I'm looking on his website right now, and some of the specific things here is that he's going to end U.S. support for the Saudi-led intervention in Yemen. And there's a lot of very vague things like implement a foreign policy focusing on human rights and democracy. I'd love to get more specifics on what he wants to do. He's going to rejoin the Iran nuclear agreement. Do you know more about specifics?
A little bit. I mean, just, you know, by the record and also by things that he has said in some foreign policy speeches. In 2015, 2016, he did give a major foreign policy speech, and he's done a couple during the course of this campaign. So you have some sense. And frankly, where he's at on foreign policy, I think it's safe to say, is that he really is a candidate who sort of pushes beyond the traditional bipartisan sort of settlement, if you will, on foreign policy. Mm-hmm. And that is a situation where Democrats and Republicans, while they may differ on some specifics, often end up in a broad sense in much the same place.
Right.
Sanders has for a long time been a critic of this, and he's argued that, and he was very early on it, arguing that these endless wars really are problematic, that they don't solve problems. He's had some pretty strong and detailed statements writing for some foreign policy publications about the need to really, you know, rethink the U.S. engagement with military actions, wars, bases, all sorts of things around the world, and to draw that back to some extent, put a greater emphasis on foreign aid, diplomacy. This is not so different from where a number of progressive Democrats like Ro Khanna, Barbara Lee, Mark Pocan, and others are at. So I wouldn't necessarily, I don't think there's much about him that's particularly radical in this regard. He is a very much of a sort of new critique of foreign policy that has roots, frankly, in older critiques. I my sense is that that's where he's at. The one thing that I would suggest is that as regards Israel-Palestine, his willingness to not just to answer questions about it and take stands when asked, but also to affirmatively bring up Palestinian rights is a distinctive thing in our politics. That's newer in presidential politics. Again, not unheard of. There have been candidates in the past, like people like Dennis Kucinich, who've run and raised some of these issues and raised some of these concerns. But I think Sanders as a leading contender to do that is quite significant. The final thing that I'll note is, and I've covered Sanders for a long time, I cannot emphasize how early he was on bringing up climate crisis and on talking about the need to build international alliances on that. Years ago, he always included it as a major part of his critique and a major part of what he's talking about. And increasingly in this current campaign, in his speeches, he has specifically talked about dialing down spending on the military-industrial complex and moving spending and sort of foreign policy focus, energy, toward addressing the climate crisis, which is I have to tell you, at his rallies, it's a big applause line, a huge applause line. And that's interesting because not everybody makes that calculation, right, of we're spending an immense amount on military. We're not putting enough energy into addressing the climate crisis. To kind of find those intersections and talk about that is, in my mind, a distinctive thing.
Right.
And one final element, just to throw in the mix for what it's worth. In one of the most interesting clashes of the 2000 2016 campaign. At a debate in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, Sanders and Hillary Clinton were on stage. And Hillary Clinton spoke at some length about how she was respectful of Henry Kissinger. And when Sanders came back on, he was very, very detailed in his saying, I don't like Henry Kissinger, and I don't agree with him, and he won't be a part of anything I do. And then going into, if you go back and look at that February 2016 debate, going into a long critique, which I haven't heard him do, or many people do at this level of presidential politics, of U.S. interventions in countries going back to Iraq in the 50s and Guatemala and Vietnam. And it was kind of, it was a interesting glimpse of the guy that, you know, his critique actually is rather deep and extended. And it is definitely one that is at odds with a lot of the foreign policy establishment.
Today we're speaking with John Nichols, National Affairs Correspondent at The Nation. He also hosts their podcast, Next Left. And today we continue our series on the presidential candidates. We're talking about Bernie Sanders, who is now the clear front runner according to major polls. In the last week, over 50,000 people attended rallies for Sanders. He's raised a whopping $109 million. He's taking no money from billionaires. He's getting the most money from individual donors. If you have a question about Bernie Sanders, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall at kalw.org or tweet us at yourcallradio. John will be with us for about 10 more minutes, and then we are going to talk about Sanders' support in the Latinx community. Let's go to Brad in Columbus, Ohio. Hi, Brad. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. I have actually sort of two questions, but it's also based around Medicare for All. And for the sake, I'm an Elizabeth Warren supporter. But anyways, one thing I don't understand is why they make this argument so complicated between Sanders and Warren both. I mean, it's very simple. First off, say the argument is it would cost around $35 to $40 trillion a year to implement their plan. I don't know why they just simply don't retort, well, right now, currently, the last report was around $3.6 trillion per year. So if you average it over 10 years, yeah, it's between $36 and $40 trillion right now. So it's the same money. It's just how you're going to spend it. And that would make it much more simpler for people to understand. And the second point, which I don't understand, but I don't raise, to make it very simple, is that right now, access to medical care in the United States is lowest in the bottom 20 states. Where that exists are the states that are most supporting Donald Trump. So if Medicare for All would, in fact, allow, because the money would be there, for there to be more and more medical access in all the states being more uniformly set out, it's more an advantage to those states now that are supporting him, supporting Trump, which are not getting what they're looking for. This is very simple.
Well, thank you for the call. John, what about the first part of the question? Why can't they describe Medicare for All? I mean, we know how the media works. You have to have simple sound bites, especially
sure
on the cable
do.
Shows.
Yeah, and look, at the end of the day, I think Medicare for All is an adaptation from the term single-payer health care, right? And single-payer, the argument was, well, people had a hard time understanding that. So now you go to Medicare for All because everybody likes Medicare. And, you know, somehow that will work. But the truth of the matter is that our media does an incredibly lousy job of covering the basic economics on this stuff. And the caller just nailed it, right? He went through the data, and there you go. It took seconds, and he did it perfectly, as far as I can tell. And our media just won't do that. They you know, so much default to the simplistic, you know, basically health insurance industry arguments that somehow it's going to be, you know, disastrously expensive. It isn't. And I wonder whether it isn't better just simply to say healthcare is a right, period. And force your, you know, your opponents, your critics, whatever, to argue it isn't. I mean, have that debate. And once you've established that healthcare is a right, then, yeah, you got to make sure that people have it, you know. And so I wonder whether at some point still progressives, the left, begin the discussion one step ahead of where it ought to start. I'm not sure of that, but that's kind of a gut instinct for covering this issue now for a very long time. I will note that Sanders, and to a lesser extent Warren, do a lot of what the caller is suggesting. And sometimes they both, Sanders and Warren, do it very, very well in debate settings. If you go back to July of last summer when there was a debate in Detroit, Sanders and Warren really did a masterful job of kind of working together to see off all the critiques of Medicare for All. And I think it's the standout, as regards to that issue, the standout debate of the campaign. The incredible thing to me is that while they did that, I thought strikingly effectively in that debate, each debate after, the moderators come back to the same questions. You know, they it's as if you can't somehow with our current media system and our current political system, no matter how much information you marshal, no matter how well you do it, it's almost as if you can't win the debate. They will not let you win. They will always, you know, go back to the same arguments, and so it's kind of like being on a hamster wheel. You're constantly, you know, running through it, explaining it, detailing it, and then, you know, a week later, you end up saying, "Well, but it won't work." And so I think it's a frustrating, challenging reality in our politics. And frankly, I think it is a media problem. I think our media, simply as in an overall media system, is not comfortable calling that one and just saying, look, the data's here, here's the reality. Maybe you don't want government to do this for whatever reason, that's fine, but let's get beyond the silly arguments about cost.
John, can you stick around with us for just a few more minutes? Because we have a few emails that I'd like you to respond to.
Yes, like I said, I've got till about 40 after.
Okay, that's perfect. So before we go to break, since you brought up Medicare for All, Brad, I just wanted to mention there is a brand new study out from Yale, the University of Florida, and the University of Maryland, and it found that transitioning to a single-payer Medicare for All system would save $450 billion a year. The average family would see $2,400 in savings. This is the very important, too. It would prevent 68,000 unnecessary deaths per year. And we're definitely going to do a show about Medicare for All in the coming weeks. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW San Francisco. If you have a perspective you haven't heard in today's discussion, or a question that you feel needs to be answered, please join the conversation by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, toll free. You can also send an email to yourcall@kalw.org or post a comment or question at the show's website, yourcallradio.org. Or you can tweet us. Our handle is @yourcallradio.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. We are doing a two-week series on presidential candidates' records, donors, and policy plans. Yesterday, we talked about Pete Buttigieg. Tomorrow, we'll talk about Elizabeth Warren. Today, we're talking about Bernie Sanders. And John, I have a few emails I want to read to you. We really wanted to focus on the issues, but a lot of people are really asking about Bernie's viability. And so I'll read a few, and then you can respond. Noel writes, will the corporate Dems oppose Bernie even if he wins the nomination? I could see them sacrificing this election to make a point to their corporate donors that they have their back and real grassroots democracy will not be allowed. Thank you for that. Tim writes, Bernie's an existential threat to the status quo. Not surprised that all media outlets are nervous. When he exposes the fact that they're owned by one percenters, they get nervous. Comcast is not going to let MSNBC talk about how much of their revenue comes from attack ads. Well, we're going to talk about Bloomberg next week and all the millions he's spending on these TV ads. Robert writes, I like Bernie's policy platforms, but I worry about his ability to get things done if he is elected. And he put in a few things about Bernie's record and what he's actually done. And Pamela says, what are Bernie's chances of winning in swing states? So that's a lot, John, but we're getting a lot of questions along those lines.
And you know what? Thanks for you for doing these shows, by the way. And I think it's very appropriate to blend the issue discussion with the electability discussion.
Right.
Because, of course, a candidate can promise anything, right? It is a question of whether you might have some shot at actually getting power to do those things. So the callers are wise, or the emailers are wise to extend the discussion. And here's a basic answer to it, and hopefully satisfying, but one that I know that we could go a whole lot deeper on, particularly on those first questions. I have a new book coming out, I think in May it'll publish, and it's called The Fight for the Soul of the Democratic Party. It's a history of the last 75 years of the Democratic Party, and it is an argument that again and again and again, party insiders and their corporate sponsors and more conservative forces have indeed tried very, very hard to keep their concession, to keep the Democratic Party as a more centrist, more cautious party. And they have, at times, really come very close to, not wholly, but very close to abandoning candidates like a George McGovern in 72, who, you know, do threaten to change the party. You had a Democrats for McGovern movement in 1972 that was actually quite large. Had governors and senators and members of Congress and mayors supporting it. And so there is a frustration there, and on the part of, I think, a lot of progressives. They are always told that if a more conservative candidate is nominated, they all have to get on board. But then if a progressive candidate is nominated, there's history that says that many of the more cautious, more conservative, more centrist Democrats don't get on board. Trump is a bigger threat, and a more complex threat. And so I think it would be harder, frankly, for a lot of Democrats to abandon or to undermine a Sanders candidacy. I think that's something that really has to be emphasized. I do think there is more possibility of uniting the party than there may have been sometimes in the past, even around a very progressive candidate. The key to this, I would argue, is twofold. Number one, the choice of the vice presidential candidate. I think the vice presidential pick this year, no matter who the nominee is going to be hugely significant. I always laugh at people who say, oh, vice presidential picks don't matter. They always matter. The thing is that often candidates pick lousy vice presidential candidates, and it matters because it makes their campaigns weaker. Smart candidates take risks and build a ticket out that has potential to expand the appeal. The classic examples: Nixon in 1960, Kennedy in 1960 against Nixon, picking Lyndon Johnson, somebody that he didn't particularly like, but could help him win Texas. Reagan in 1980, picking George W. Bush, a harsh critic of Reagan, a guy who talked about voodoo economics because Reagan felt he needed to get those Main Street, more moderate Republicans. If Sanders is a nominee, he's got to look at, you know, how he, you know, unites the party. That is a part of the task. But then there's also a second component, which I think is actually more important, and that is to, you know, go all in for an argument. And this is an argument about 2020. And that is that rather than searching for a handful of swing voters in the middle, what you really ought to do is build out the voting base and reach out to tremendous numbers of young people, reach out to disenfranchised and disenchanted voters across, you know, racial lines, ethnic lines, regional lines, and try and build out something different. So in the mix of that is an argument that Sanders is actually quite electable and, you know, ought to be taken seriously as such. But it's partially his job to make that case.
Well, John, we will definitely continue this conversation. I think you have another phone line to get there. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Rose.
Thanks, John. John Nichols is national affairs correspondent with The Nation, and he hosts their Next Left podcast. Now we're going to talk about what is happening in Nevada and specifically talk about the Latinx vote. Now we're joined by Julio Ricardo Varela. Julio is digital media director for Futuro Media. He's also co-host of In the Thick and founder of LatinoRebels.com. Hi, Julio. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm good. Thank you so much. Christian Paz is an editorial fellow covering politics with The Atlantic, and he has written about Bernie and the Latinx vote. Hi, Christian. Thank you for joining us.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you so much. So Latinos make up about a third of Nevada's population. And according to The Intercept, Sanders has 10 offices and over 200 staffers in Nevada. 54 are Latino. Make the Road Action, an immigrant rights group, has never made a presidential endorsement before, and they are endorsing Bernie, hoping to knock on 600,000 doors nationwide this year. Julio, what can you tell us about the ground game in Nevada and what's really changed when it comes to Bernie and his relationship with Latinos?
You know, I don't think really much has changed. I think you have to look at this in the context of 2016. He almost won. Right, and his base was young Latinos. It was more of a multiracial, multi-ethnic type coalition. And I think the campaign, and talking to people in the campaign, senior advisors like Chuck Rocha, and even someone like Jeff Weaver, who I talked to in New Hampshire, when I asked him straight up, you know, why is Bernie doing so well with Latino voters in 2020? And it's part of their strategy. They went back and they said, you know what, there was an electorate here that supported us in 2016. Maybe if we start investing more money and more on-the-ground support and actually do outreach in places like Las Vegas, which he did lose to Clinton in Nevada, but also in places like Las Vegas and other urban areas around the country, maybe that's our strategy. You know, your previous caller talked about expanding the base. That's a strategy by the Sanders campaign. They're just like, we're going to turn out more people than Donald Trump. We're going to come out and get new voters. Who knows how that plays out, but that is a strategy. And now, you know, Bernie Sanders is the front runner. He has yet to lose. So we'll see.
Christian, what would you add? You wrote a piece called Bernie Sanders' Biggest Test Yet with Latino Voters.
Yeah, I think that's the right starting point there, that the Sanders campaign really learned from 2016 in terms of it mattering and it actually being a pretty good gamble to try to invest early on, try to recruit regionally, try to engage pretty consistently with Latino voters specifically because it's such a big part of the Democratic electorate and it's a huge, that which matters in the primary season, that if you were to begin early and get to those voters who haven't been reached by other campaigns and make sure that you keep them engaged throughout the season, that these voters will end up turning out. And I think that's something that was visible in Iowa and New Hampshire, even though they are predominantly white states, the small Latino populations there actually played a major role in the Sanders victory in New Hampshire and in the tie and the popular vote result in Iowa. One of the things that I reported in this piece for the Atlantic was that the estimates right now, there aren't any official counts yet on how many Hispanic and Latino voters turned out in the Iowa caucuses. But given that it was a caucus, it was expected that turnout wouldn't be as greater as in the primary state. Despite that, one of the experts I spoke to for this piece, he estimated that Latino voters might have doubled in terms of their turnout in the Iowa caucuses, and that those Latino-heavy precincts may have been the ones that have gave Sanders an advantage in tying with Pete Buttigieg in the SBE equivalent and in terms of just winning raw popular votes in the caucus.
We have a question from John who says, is Senator Sanders conducting similar operations in southwestern states? It could be an opportunity to flip some red states.
Yeah, he is. I mean, and I think to Christian's point, we also wrote that about that UCLA study out of Iowa where it was 32 Latinos, like Latino-dominant caucus areas, districts. It was targeted. It was micro-targeted, and I think it's the margin, right? Also, it happened in New Hampshire.
as well. I mean, a place like Nashua, New Hampshire, which is very immigrant, very diverse, a little bit more reflective of the United States, Sanders did really well. So you got to look at places like California. California, Colorado, Arizona. You know, his deputy Latino media press secretary, Ben Encisa, who is who's a dreamer, she's from Arizona. So Bernie Sanders they are investing in this strategy. It is part, and what was very telling to me is when someone like Jeff Weaver, who, you know, is not Latino, he's a white liberal man, I asked him straight up in New Hampshire, he's like, it is an integral, it's part of our strategy. It's no longer seen as sort of separate. So we are looking at it as actual, how do we get delegates, and how do we get votes, and how do we look at ourselves as a viable candidate and build a multiracial, multi-ethnic coalition? It's very intentional. And I think that's the one thing that is being missed in this entire political process, and especially coming out of Las Vegas and Nevada and before the debate, is that I don't know. I mean, I know the Warren campaign did a little bit. I don't think anyone's on the same level as Sanders right now with this type of strategy. And it will be interesting to see, because it is such a contrast from, let's look for the moderate Democrat, let's look for the Midwest swing states. And the last point I'll make, there are Latinos everywhere. Michigan, Pennsylvania, North Carolina, they're Super Tuesday states, and they're doing it. And that's something that is being, you know, this is not just about Nevada. There's right. going to be several states, and if you look at the latest Pew research about eligible voters in 2020 by state, there's an incredible breakdown of Latino eligible voters that Pew Research has done. It's on Latino Rebels right now, breaking down the entire by congressional district. So there are Latino voters everywhere, and this notion that it's like all about white voters it's not the only narrative out there.
Right. I want to ask you both about his policies. Last night at a CNN town hall, he said that he plans to rescind all of Trump's hateful and racist executive orders, in his words. He says on day one, under an executive order, he will restore the legal status of the 1.8 million people and their parents who are eligible for DACA. Julio, how significant is this? I mean, he's basically saying day one, I will do this by executive order.
Yeah, no, that it's very interesting. It is significant. And let's just be real. That comes from his campaign, by the pressure by immigrant rights activists and rights groups that have called for this. I will say one thing that's very interesting about this, and this is where I'm going to shout out my boss, Mariana Hossa, anchor of Latino USA.
Mm-hmm.
We had Sanders on last year as an interview, and she asked him straight up about this policy, about, you know, a moratorium on deportations, DACA, all the things. He wasn't as, let's say, out there, progressive. He wasn't like 100% out there. Mm-hmm. But what was interesting is when we finally published the interview the day before, he said, "Oh, I'm all for a deportation moratorium."
Huh.
So I think it's very interesting that you see places like Mi Gente, which is the group, the grassroots Latinx group that has just said we support. It's their first presidential endorsement for Sanders. That's a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
That's a big deal because that is an organization that is incredibly active. They've done work in Georgia. They've done work in parts of the Southwest, and they're going to be campaigning for Bernie Sanders. They're endorsing him. They're not part of the Bernie Sanders campaign, but for them to do an endorsement like that, because they don't take endorsements lightly, that to me says that the immigrant rights community and at least the activist community is behind Sanders on a lot of levels.
Christian, what would you add? Nidhi Prakash had an interesting piece at BuzzFeed. It says, Bernie used to get knocked over his immigration record. He spent years talking with activists and has shifted his approach. And she quoted Jess Morales Roquetto, a former Hillary advisor who's now director with the National Domestic Workers Alliance. And she said, quote, Sanders has made wild shifts. And you know what? It's incredible. Where he is now is absolutely outstanding. I'm impressed. And it's hard to impress me when it comes to him.
Yeah, I think it is a testament, as Julia was mentioning, that a testament to his willingness to listen to activists and to members of these communities that he's trying to use to build this multi-ethnic, multi-racial coalition to expand the base, as he's made the point throughout his campaign. I think the really significant thing here also is that the Sanders campaign, while focusing on immigration and considering the concerns of activists and immigration rights activists, hasn't just used immigration as the only talking point when talking about the Latino community, which is something that can be a pitfall for some other campaigns. When they think about their Hispanic or Latino outreach programs, they might think of exclusively immigration. One of the things that was really interesting to see was Bernie Sanders' video conference into a presidential town hall that LULAC, the League of United Latin American Citizens, was hosting in Las Vegas last week. I believe Amy Klobuchar and Pete Buttigieg and Tom Steyer were also there.
Right.
One of the interesting things, though, was in his responses, you wouldn't hear, he got a few questions about Latinos and about immigration and about, you know, the economy and climate change. And in each of those responses, he made sure to weave in Latinos and Hispanic people into those responses so that it wasn't a pandering kind of approach. It was it presented itself as a very serious consideration of Latinos as people whose issues aren't just Latino issues. They're issues that affect all kinds of Americans, whether it's, you know, raising the minimum wage, or it's focusing on getting affordable health care, or addressing climate change and the issues with environmental racism and what's called environmental justice, right? And those kinds of responses and those kinds of answers demonstrate a sophisticated understanding and a nuanced understanding of how Latinos aren't exclusively concerned. They're not one monolithic voting bloc. They're not only concerned about immigration and immigration reform, because there are so many Latinos who will be voting who might not be considering immigration or immigration policy as one of the main issues that they're that's motivating their decision when they do go to caucus or they do go to vote in the primary.
Christian Paz is an editorial fellow covering politics with The Atlantic. Julio Ricardo Valera is digital media director for Futuro Media and co-host of In the Thick with Maria Hinojosa. Julio founded LatinoRebels.com in 2011. Today we're talking about Bernie Sanders. We're doing a series on all the candidates. The other thing Sanders said at the CNN town hall last night is he's going to end Trump's border policy. He said federal agents will not be snatching babies from the arms of their mothers, and they will not be throwing children into cages. We have a question about the Culinary Workers Union in Nevada not endorsing a candidate and, you know, saying that they are opposed to Bernie's Medicare for All plan. Let's hear from Greg in Palo Alto. Hi, Greg.
Hello. I'm glad to hear that what your guests are saying about the Latino or Hispanic vote and people supporting Sanders. I think that's really a hopeful sign. I guess the only question I had to bring up is I don't think his positions are radical. Anybody who looked at his positions would see that they're basically good for everybody in this country. But with regard to the culinary workers in Nevada, I don't know why they couldn't make a comparison. Just lay out a sheet. You know, here's our health plan. Here's what he's calling for, Medicare for All. How is our plan better than Medicare for All? Because that seems to be their claim. They fought hard for their health plan. I give them kudos for that, getting what they got. But I don't think, I mean, unless they've got the Cadillac of all health care plans, I doubt that it's going to be better than Medicare for All. And the other thing, too, is if they lose their job, their health care is not going to go with them. Medicare for All would. So I'm just curious about that.
Well, thanks, Greg. So for a little bit of background, we're talking about a very powerful union in Nevada, 60,000
right.
members. They have fought for years for their health care plan, and they are singling out Bernie Sanders as the only candidate who would get rid of it, and they have not endorsed a candidate. Julio?
So there's so much to unpack here. First of all, people need to be reminded that in 2016, the culinary union's worker, they didn't endorse anyone either. They didn't endorse Clinton nor Sanders. And so that's important. I mean, this notion that there wasn't an endorsement, there's a history to that. Mm-hmm. But a couple of things that people need to understand about culinary, and I've been doing some reporting and actually been in Vegas and talking to them. When that press conference happened, it was actually when they decided not to endorse, they basically focused on three things: healthcare, economic justice, and immigration. And they kind of turned it over to their rank and file. And one of the things that people need to understand about their rank and file, that it's mostly Latina, mostly. It's very multi-ethnic, and it's also multiracial. So what's important here about this context is that knowing that the memberships, like you have, it's a classic case of the leadership and membership might be disagreeing, and they're allowing the members to vote for themselves. So I think a lot is being put in. There's a lot of talk about it, but I don't think there's anything different that happened in, say, 2016, where Clinton won in Nevada. So I wouldn't read much into it, and even talking to people who have been following Nevada politics for a while, they kind of feel the same way. It's pretty clear with the early voting numbers that have come out, and also with all the polls that are coming out about Sanders, that he is the front runner. And if he wins in Nevada on Saturday, I don't think anyone's going to be surprised. They'll only be surprised if he doesn't. So we'll see. I mean, this is politics, and, you know, there's a couple of days, and who knows what's happening
right
behind the scenes. But, you know, there's an election on Saturday.
Christian, we have just about a minute left. Anything to add there?
I think that's precisely right. I think the other thing to note here is that the Sanders campaign is hoping that its direct outreach to members of the union is something that will trump any kind of influence or any appearance of an overbearing influence by union leaders. They are counting on the outreach to Latinas and to immigrant members who make up the union's membership. They're just hoping that the strategy that they began in April will be something that influences their vote more than what media organizations or what union bosses might be thinking.
Julio, final thoughts. Are there any other issues, for example, that you have uncovered, that you've heard from people on the ground who really care about, that has not got much attention?
I think people need to stop with the narrative that are like we're suddenly discovering like Nevada Latino voters. Like they've been there for, you know, 10 years ago they got Harry Reid reelected. 2 years ago they got a couple of years ago they got the first Latina senator in the history of the United States elected. It's a very active, politically engaged community. Mm-hmm. And, you know, obviously the focus is on them now because of Saturday or the caucuses, but there's nothing there that hasn't happened. You're talking about a lot of people who really feel like there's a civic participation. And there are a lot of good people that are working for a lot of those campaigns, whether it's Steyer or Warren or Biden or Sanders, who have local Nevada political ties, and they really have this belief in democracy and in participation, and I think that's being missed.
I think it's a great point, and the Las Vegas Review-Journal reports that the early voting totals is more than 70,000 votes, which is fantastic. I mean, unfortunately, people stood in three-hour lines, but so many people are voting early, and now we'll see what happens on caucus day on Saturday.
Yeah.
Julio Ricardo Varela is digital media director for Fortuoro Media. He's co-host of In the Thick and founder of LatinoRebels.com. Julio, thank you so much for joining us.
It was a pleasure.
Christian Paz is editorial fellow covering politics with The Atlantic. Christian, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Coming up tomorrow, we'll continue our series on presidential candidates by talking about Elizabeth Warren. Most in the broadcast media ignored her third-place victory in Iowa. Her speech after the New Hampshire primary was not carried live, and the pundits barely talk about her. So what explains this? That's tomorrow, and be sure to watch the debate tonight, 6 p.m. Pacific. Michael Bloomberg is going to be on stage. Thanks to Leah Cesarine for producing today's show, Joanne Marr, our studio engineer. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.